Tully sat in the sizable vault area, rocking back and forth in hopes of somehow tipping the chair over, perhaps breaking it, and in that way managing to free his bound arms and legs. His gagged mouth was aching from the tape that was across it. He heard footsteps and braced himself for the likelihood that Two-Face was coming back to kill him, or perhaps instead to play that demented coin-tossing game of his again. Instead, a caped figure stepped into the narrow entranceway to the vault. Tully's eyes went wide. It was him. Damn it! It was him! Except it couldn't be him. It mustn't! Tully made frantic noises in his throat, trying in some way to warn him off. But Batman moved quickly to Tully, freed his hands, and tore the tape off his mouth. Pain roared through Tully's face, but that didn't stop him from getting out the words, "It's a trap!" It was a useful, if somewhat tardy, sentence. The safe door slammed shut before Batman could even turn. Before the resounding clang of the heavy metal barrier had even begun to fade, Two-Face's voice issued from a speaker hidden somewhere within the vault. "Good evening, Mr. Bat," he said in a grave imitation of an old television series. "Your mission, should you choose to accept it or not, is simple. Die." Batman and Tully were hurled to the floor as the safe jerked forward, starting to move. There was the sound of chains outside, dragging across the floor. "We have a problem," said Batman. By the time Gordon's people had gotten to the huge crane that had operated the wrecking ball, all they found was an empty cab. The monstrous machine had done its work, and the operators, more of Two-Face's people, no doubt, had fled. Gordon banged a car hood in frustration, feeling helpless. Then he heard something. It was the unmistakable sound of whirling helicopter blades. He looked up towards the 22nd floor and moved from helplessness to utter shock. A Black Hawk helicopter had moved into position, a giant winch dangling beneath it. It seemed to be drawing something through the huge hole that the wrecking ball had pounded in the side of the building. After a moment, Gordon was able to make out what it was. It was the safe from within the bank, dangling hundreds of feet above the ground and being drawn slowly up into the helicopter's cargo hold. Gordon swore under his breath. "I just hope to God that Batman and the hostage are safe." Inside the safe, Batman was able to figure out, from the swaying of the vault and the pounding of the whirling blades outside, just exactly what the situation was.
"Why does he want to kill you?"
asked Tully apprehensively.
"I was his friend,"
replied Batman, scanning the interior of the vault in the hopes of finding a way out.
"Do all your friends want to kill you?"
"Only the ones who get to know me."
What Batman had spotted, which he didn't like one bit, were small spigots on the wall. What the hell did they have to do with anything? Once again, Two-Face's voice came through the hidden speakers.
2 years ago tonight you abandoned us to that madhouse. So, happy anniversary! And for your dying pleasure, we're serving the very same acid that made yours truly the men we are today."
The purpose of the spigots was quickly made clear. Acid, with a reddish color that had long seared itself into Batman's memory, started pouring out of them. Wherever the acid struck, there was a loud hissing and rising smoke. The acid wasn't strong enough to eat through steel, so the money, safely ensconced in steel drawers, would be unharmed. But Batman and Tully weren't in quite as fortunate a position.
"When we open this safe," crowed Two-Face, "we'll have all we ever wanted. Enough cash to open a mint, and you dead."
Batman steepled his legs, feet pressing on opposite sides of the wall in front of the safe door. It gave him some elevation, but not much. Acid started to burn at his cape. He looked around, fighting down desperation, and suddenly his eyes lit on something useful.
"I need to borrow this," he said, and grabbed the guard's hearing aid.
Holding it to the door, he used it to augment his own hearing and started working the combination. He focused his concentration, not rushing his way through the soft clicks of the tumblers.
"Once we were allies, bound by a passion to fight evil," Two-Face told him.
The guard, from his precarious perch, wiped the sweat from his face. He accidentally knocked off his glasses. They fell into the rising acid and turned molten in no time.
"Know what I've learned, Bat, old pal? Passion burns."
And as the acid started pumping in faster, he called out in demented joy,
"Burn, Batty, burn!"
The final tumbler clicked into place. Batman threw open the door, grabbing the door jamb in one hand, the guard in the other, and swung out onto the safe's top just as the floor of hissing acid streamed past below his feet. Then he pulled out his wire poon and fired it into the bank wall. The hook embedded solidly, and Batman quickly attached the trailing end of the cable to the safe with another hook, snapping it into place. He wasn't sure how heavy the safe was. He suspected the cable was sufficient. With his free hand, he reached up and grabbed the chain that was suspending the safe.
"Hang on."
"What?"
shouted the guard. Batman gripped the chain and, using the torch, sliced at the links just below his hand. The safe swung down and away, the cable line drawing taut. In a perfect arc, the safe swung back through the hole from which it had emerged mere moments ago. It slid across the floor, skidding with the sound of screeching metal, and slammed into the far wall. Batman, in the meantime, was clambering up the chain toward the open cargo hatch. The yank upwards had been so quick, so violent, that it had knocked the blowtorch out of his hand. But he was going to rein in Harvey Dent, and nothing was going to stop him. From within the cockpit, Two-Face stared down in pure fury. The pilot started to ask what it was that Two-Face wanted him to do when Two-Face grabbed the controls away from him, yanked back on the throttle, and sent the chopper shooting straight up into the night sky like a rocket. The helicopter angled towards Gotham Harbor, where a giant sign read, "Welcome to Gotham City." Two-Face gunned the chopper's engines and angled toward the sign. He ignored the pilot's cries of terror that he was coming in too low. Two-Face sent the helicopter roaring downward, the lower half and trailing chain smashing through the sign, ripping it to shreds. As if he'd totally forgotten about piloting the chopper, Two-Face moved away from the controls so that he could better see out the side. The pilot quickly grabbed control of the chopper as Two-Face made his way over to the cargo hatch. He peered down at the chain and saw exactly what he thought he'd see. Nothing.
"Goodbye to that pointy-eared, steroid-eating, rubber-suited, cross-dressing night rat!"
Then a shadow suddenly cast itself over him. The only source of light was through the windshield, and with a berserk yell, Two-Face spun. Sure enough, covering the plexiglass windshield was a familiar black cape. Two-Face yanked out his guns and started firing. Bullets went everywhere, through the windshield, through the cape, and, unfortunately, through the pilot. The pilot slumped forward on the stick, sending the chopper into a dive. Two-Face was hurled forward. He smashed into the windshield, which was already riddled with bullet holes. It cracked further under the impact, and Two-Face scrambled back so that he wouldn't crash completely through it and be hurled down to the icy water below. He grabbed the pilot's corpse, wrested it from its position, and tossed it aside. Then he clambered into the vacated seat and regained control of the spiraling chopper. That was when a fist smashed through the side window, tagging Two-Face squarely on the jaw. His head snapped back, crashing into the cushioned wall behind him. Crouched on one of the struts on the outside of the speeding helicopter, Batman hung on with single-minded determination.
"Harvey, you need help. Give it up."
Suddenly Harvey brought his feet up, slamming them squarely into Batman's face.
"Mano a bato!"
called Two-Face as Batman lost his grip, sliding and having to grab onto the lower half of the strut. Batman took a breath, then hauled himself back up, ripping apart the last remains of the side door that were acting as a barrier to him. He grabbed Two-Face's foot, flipped him to the floor, and started dragging him out of the helicopter. Two-Face struggled back furiously.
"I've spent 2 years in Arkham Asylum planning your demise," Two-Face called. "There's only one way out of this waltz. One of us dies!"
"I won't kill you, Harvey."
But Batman's actions were contradicting his words. His fingers found Two-Face's throat and clamped down, adrenaline pumping, instinct pushing him.
"Batman doesn't kill," said Harvey. "What's that homicidal gleam in your eye? That lethal curl of your lip? Oh, too good to be true. A bat with a taste for blood. We're just the same," he said. "You're a killer, too."
For a moment, Batman's concentration was thrown. A second later, so was Batman, as he vanished from sight beneath the chopper. Harvey yanked himself back into the chopper and looked at the course in front of him. There was the Lady Gotham statue, recently refurbished, standing proudly in the harbor. Two-Face smiled as it all came together.
"Hello, my lovely. Ready for your facelift?"
He reached under the seat and pulled out a large iron brace he used to lock the controls into place, fixing the helicopter on its deadly course.
"Let the world be made new in our split image!"
Clutching onto the underside support strut, Batman hauled himself up once more toward the open side of the helicopter. With a thrust of his powerful legs, he shoved himself into the cockpit. No sign of Harvey. What he did see were two things: the iron bar holding the chopper steady, and Harvey Dent poised over the cargo hatch. It was as if he'd been waiting for Batman to show up.
"This time, have the good taste to die,"
Dent requested in a rather formal tone, and he leaped through the cargo hatch. Batman moved quickly to the cargo hatch and stared in stunned disbelief as Harvey Dent plummeted towards the dark water below. There was a sudden flurry of expanding color caught in Lady Gotham's lighthouse beam, and a parachute opened over Two-Face. And then the helicopter smashed into the left side of Lady Gotham's face. Batman was hurled through the cargo hatch as the Black Hawk erupted in a massive fireball, consuming part of the statue's visage and transforming it, in a matter of seconds, into a damaged, ugly parody of itself. Batman had just enough time to curve his body into a diving form, and then he split the water. He vanished beneath the water's surface, and to any onlooker, had there been any, it would have seemed impossible that Batman would be resurfacing. But he broke the surface, gasping for air, arms and legs moving desperately, trying to keep himself above water. Within moments he'd steadied himself enough, and then he trod water and looked up at the ungodly illumination high above him. Half of Lady Gotham's once beautiful face was still flaming, a blazing mockery of all of Batman's efforts. Then he began the long, unpleasant swim to shore, as the burning Lady Gotham lit the way. Someone was working late at Wayne Enterprises. Edward Nigma was hunched over his device, working at a fever pitch. Then an officious voice sounding like a cross between a foghorn and a Rottweiler snapped from the entrance to his cubicle.
"What the hell is going on here?"
Edward looked up at Stickley, his eyes not even fully focusing on him.
"I told you your project is terminated."
Nigma gave no response, but that was okay with Stickley. He wasn't looking for any. Instead, he smiled nastily.
"For that matter, I'm canceling you, Nigma. You deliberately disobeyed me. That was insubordination. But not only that, you roughed up Bruce Wayne and subjected him to your fixation. That was just plain stupid."
He waited for a reaction, but all he saw was the fevered intensity of Edward Nigma's gaze centered on him. He turned away gruffly and said,
"I'm calling security."
He got 2 feet before Edward brought the coffee pot crashing down on his head. Stickley went down without a sound. When Stickley awoke, he wasn't sure where he was at first. He was strapped to a rolling swivel chair. Then he became aware that there was something balanced on his head. He nodded back and forth, trying to shake it off. It felt like a hat, or... There were wires trailing from whatever it was to a machine of some sort. And now enough of his confusion fell away so that he was able to perceive Edward Nigma wearing a similar rig on his own head, making what seemed to be final adjustments. Nigma must have somehow sensed that Stickley had come too, because he said, "This won't hurt a bit." Then he gave the matter a moment's thought and added, "At least, I don't think it will." Stickley bellowed,
"Nigma, you press that button and..."
"And what? I'm fired?"
He flipped a switch. The TV screen flared to life, and hovering there in the glow was a holographic representation of Stickley reeling in a prize bass. Then the figures began to waver and tremble.
"Losing resolution," muttered Edward to himself. "More power."
He threw a second switch, and immediately warning lights flared to life. A white beam lanced out from the TV into Stickley's headband. One look at Stickley's glazed, slack expression made it quite clear that he was not aware of anything at all. But Nigma looked invigorated, even reborn. The normal glimmer of twisted genius had been accelerated by somewhere around a factor of 100. It was as if his brain had been blown in an infinite number of directions all at once and was now hurriedly reassembling itself. And from that reassembly came
different impulses, different thoughts, a scattergun of personalities and notions. People that Nigma and or Stickley had met or hated or loved or had made any impression on him at all. All of them bubbling to the surface, struggling for their moment, fighting for dominance.
Sounding much like the host of a game show, Edward barked,
"Enigma, come on down. You're the next contestant on Brain Drain. I'll take what's inside Thick Skull Number One."
Then Edward's own personality, what there was of it at any rate, came roaring back to the surface.
"Stickley, I've had a breakthrough.
And a breakdown? Maybe. Nevertheless, I'm smarter. I'm a genius. No, several geniuses. A flock of freaking Freuds. Riddle me this, Fred. What is everything to someone and nothing to everyone else?"
"Your mind, of course. And now mine pumps with the power of yours."
With what little control he had left, Nigma reached over and shut off the machine. The light flickered and died, and with a sigh, as if having just physically separated from a lover, Nigma muttered,
"What a rush!"
Then Stickley spoke. The reason this was so interesting to Edward was that he had no clue that Stickley would be able to speak, or think, or make himself understood after the treatment. So being subjected to this device wasn't terminal.
What the hell just happened?"
Nigma smiled gleefully. "While you were mesmerized by my 3D TV, I utilized your neural energy to grow smarter."
Boisterously he added,
"I am a Columbus of the mind! Land ho!"
It took Stickley a few moments to truly comprehend what it was that Nigma was telling him. Nigma had been what? Fluttering around in his brain? Sucking away his neural energy? It was like some sort of mind rape. Making no attempt to restrain his fury, Stickley roared,
"Bruce Wayne was right, you demented, bizarre, unethical toad. It is mind manipulation. I'm reporting you to the FCC, the Human Experimentation Board, the AMA, the police, the federal government. But first and foremost, Nigma, you are fired. Do you hear me? Fired!"
Cackling with demented glee, Nigma shot back,
"I don't think so."
He lashed out with a foot, kicking the chair to which Stickley had been tied. The chair rolled back across the slick floor at high speed, Stickley yelling obscenities and totally unaware of his jeopardy until he smashed through the large round window at the end of the corridor. Stickley shrieked and stopped short. The chair was teetering on the edge. Only one thing kept him from tumbling off the precipice, and that was the long wire attached to his headband. Edward Nigma charged up to him. Then he leaned in close, gripping the wire headband. With a sneer of contempt, he said,
"Fred, babe, you're fired. Or should I say, terminated?"
He yanked the headband off Stickley, and his former boss's only means of support was gone. He barely had time to utter a screech before the chair tilted backwards and plummeted to the ground far below. Edward didn't even bother to hang around to see the landing. By the time Stickley hit, Nigma was already back at his cubicle, staring intensely at the photos of Bruce Wayne all over the interior of his cubicle.
"Questions, Mr. Wayne. My work raises too many questions."
With mind-blinding fury, he started ripping the pictures down from the walls.
"Why should you have it all and not me?"
Edward Nigma leaned against the outside of his cubicle, sobbing profusely onto the shoulder of the head of personnel. She was patting him awkwardly, not quite sure what to make of this display of grief.
"Why? Oh, why?"
he moaned inconsolably.
"I can't believe it. 2 years working in the same office, and then this."
This was a note that Nigma was thrusting into the confused woman's hands.
"I found it in my cubicle. You'll find handwriting and sentence structure matches exactly. I couldn't possibly continue here.
The memories. I'll get my things.
He ducked quickly into his cubicle, where he'd already boxed up his invention. Outside he heard voices. One of them was Bruce Wayne's. Another was older, gruff, sounded extremely cop-like. He took one final glance around, as if to imprint on his mind a final image of what he was leaving behind. That way he could carry it with him mentally as he progressed towards a greater and far more glorious future. And he took the opportunity to bolt out a side door, so that by the time Bruce Wayne and Commissioner Gordon walked past, he was barreling down the steps of the emergency stairway. Wayne and Gordon stood in front of the security console, studying the tape from the previous night. Stickley was clearly visible, writing a note which they could safely assume was the suicide note that had been turned in to the head of personnel. Upon finishing, Stickley lay the note down carefully. Then he took a chair, gripped it firmly, and using it as a battering ram, charged towards the large window at the end of the corridor. He smashed through it, clutching the chair and vanishing from sight.
"That all jibes," said Gordon. "Both your man and the chair shattered to—"
He paused.
"Sorry, Bruce, I didn't mean to upset you."
Bruce nodded in acknowledgement.
"In any event, this looks pretty cut and dry. Definitely suicide. Thanks for the help, Bruce. We'll be in touch."
Bruce shook hands briskly and then turned away from Gordon. He paused momentarily at Edward Nigma's cubicle, thinking about the intensity in the man's eyes the other day. The cubicle was fairly empty. Nigma's personal items and that odd-looking device of his were gone. Bruce stared at the vacant cubicle for a time, and then he headed to his office. Margaret followed him, scribbling furiously. She said, "Gossip Gertie and the society columnists have called a record 32 times. I think if they don't know soon who you plan to take to the charity circus, the world is surely going to end." Bruce was about to answer when he noticed something on his desk. It was an envelope.
"What's this?"
He flipped it over and scrutinized it. No postmark, no stamp. He pulled it open and read,
"If you look at the numbers upon my face, you won't find 13 any place."
He turned the paper over, but there was no signature. "It's a riddle. Numbers upon my face. 1 through 12. No 13. He shrugged at the obviousness of it. A clock. Margaret scratched her head.
"Who would send you riddles?"
He turned to her and said,
"Maggie, that's the riddle."
Edward Nigma was at work in his cluttered apartment in a run-down tenement building. He was putting the finishing touches to his second riddle.
"Guess what, Bruce Wayne?" he muttered.
"Now I'm the guy with all the answers."
He turned and looked lovingly at his modified brain scan equipment. The box. It sparkled and sputtered slightly, running self-tests and diagnostics. It was almost ready. Almost ready. He rose and went to the window, resting a hand gently on the box's gleaming surface. He looked out over the ugliness of his neighborhood, toward the gleaming spires of the uptown sections of Gotham. And beyond that, up in the hills, the residence where Bruce Wayne sat on high like great Zeus, looking down at the puny mortals and rendering judgments. This person shall be raised up, this other one cast down. Edward Nigma was going to take it away from him.
"There are 7 million brains in the naked city, and they'll all be mine."
When Alfred did not find Bruce in his bedroom, he descended to the Batcave to check. And there he was, seated in a high-backed chair. His fingers were steepled, and he was staring off into space.
"Can I get you anything, sir?"
he asked finally. "Yes," Bruce nodded slowly. "You can get me an appointment with Dr. Meridian."
"Very good, sir."
By the time he'd gotten upstairs, however, Alfred had brought in the mail and discovered the second riddle, which meant that all of a sudden Bruce Wayne's reason for going to see Dr. Meridian had changed. Dr. Meridian was a fairly new arrival to Gotham City, and Gordon had rather graciously afforded her office space at the police complex. In return, she made herself available several days a week to consult with Gordon and other police officers on various investigations. Knowing what a major supporter of the police the Wayne Foundation had always been, she had agreed to make time for Bruce Wayne. "Well, how can I help you, Mr. Wayne?" He reached into his vest pocket and pulled out two pieces of paper, tossing them onto her desk. "Somebody's been sending me love letters, one at my office, one at home. Commissioner Gordon thought you might give me your expert opinion." She read them both quickly. "A clock," she said, deciphering the first one almost as quickly as Wayne had. "But this second one, tear one off and scratch my head. What once was red is black instead." She shrugged. "A newspaper?" "No, that's black and white and red all over." He indicated the riddle. "The answer to this is a match." She nodded absently and continued to study the riddles. Letters were trimmed out of newspaper and magazine headlines, and, most disturbing, a border composed of dripping daggers. She held up one letter in either hand. "My opinion? This letter writer is a total wacko."
"Wacko?" He seemed amused. "Is that a technical term?"
"A patient may suffer from obsessional syndrome with potential homicidal inclinations. Work better for you?"
"So what you're saying is that this guy's a total wacko, right?"
She smiled slightly. "Exactly. I guess someone like you encounters more than his share of nutcases, eh?"
He looked at her levelly. "You'd be amazed."
Then he saw over her head a framed print of a bat on the wall. He pointed at it and said,
"You have a thing for bats?"
She said, "That's a Rorschach, Mr. Wayne. An ink blot. People see what they want."
Bruce didn't get any further than a simple, "Oh."
Because when he looked back at the print, he saw that it was indeed a Rorschach ink blot. Dr. Meridian watched Bruce Wayne's face carefully as he stared at the ink blot. With a raised eyebrow, she asked, "I think the question would be, do you have a thing for bats?" It was an inquiry that he clearly had no interest in answering, and every interest in avoiding. He reached over and tapped the papers.
So, this Riddler, for want of a better name, is dangerous?
She pursed her lips in thought, letting the topic drift. "What do you know about obsession?"
"A little," he said.
"Obsessions are born of fear," said Dr. Meridian. "Recall a moment of great terror. Say you associate that moment with, say, a bat. Over time, the bat's image penetrates the mind, invades every aspect of your daily life. Can you imagine something like that?"
"It's a stretch, but I'll manage."
Dr. Meridian said, "The letter writer is obsessed with you. His only escape may be to..."
"To purge the fixation. To kill me."
"Huh? You understand obsession better than you let on." He nodded slightly as he picked up a small wicker totem doll from the table.
"Still play with dolls, Doctor?"
"She's a Malaysian dream, Warden. Some cultures believe she stands sentry while you sleep and guards your dreams. Silly to you, I'm sure."
But Bruce's expression stopped her short.
Somewhere within her, her little inner psychiatrist cried, "Bingo! Pay dirt! You got him! There's something there. Start asking questions. Probe. Find out what's bothering him." She made a thrust forward, a probing question. "You're not exactly what you seem, are you, Bruce Wayne? What is it you really came here for?"
He wanted to answer her. That much she could easily see. But instead he coolly looked at his watch and said, "Oops, time's up."
"Ah, that's usually my line."
"Look, I'd love to keep chatting."
"Would you?"
"Yes, I would. But I'm going to have to get you out of those clothes."
She felt lost. "Excuse me?"
"And into a black dress."
Once her confusion was utter bafflement, he said,
"Tell me, Doctor, do you like the circus?"
It wasn't a black dress. It was dark maroon, crushed velvet. Still, it had been more than sufficient when Bruce had picked Chase up at her rented townhouse. Bruce was in his tux, and the two of them were inside the Hippodrome, next to the harbor, third row center at the Gotham Charity Circus. From the center ring, the ringmaster was calling, "Ladies and gentlemen, 70 feet above the ground, performing feats of aerial skill without a net, the Flying Graysons!"
The name Grayson immediately rang a bell with Chase, and she looked up at the family of aerialists already embarking on their trapeze act to the accompaniment of pounding drums. There were 4 of them. It shouldn't be too hard to pick out. She pointed. "Some guy was making off with my purse the other day, and that boy, that one there," and she pointed as Dick hurtled across the open air into the waiting hands of his father, who was dangling upside down from his knees. "He stopped him. His father was with him. Richard and John, those were their names. Richard and John Grayson. The boy was incredibly brave, and now I understand why. Look what he does for a living." Before she could say anything further, they suddenly found themselves with a spotlight shining directly on them. And the ringmaster was announcing, "Tonight's charity benefit has raised $375,000 for Gotham Children's Hospital. Let's thank our largest single donor, Bruce Wayne." Bruce shrugged to Chase in a what-are-you-going-to-do manner and stood, taking a quick bow before quickly regaining his seat. "And now," continued the ringmaster, "Richard, the youngest Flying Grayson, will perform the awe-inspiring death drop." Chase watched raptly, as did Bruce. Dick Grayson stood on the highest platform. Grabbing the trapeze bar, he swung out high into the air above the crowd. And then, as he soared above the center of the arena, Dick released the trapeze. He fell, somersaulting in midair, over and over again. The crowd was a blur around him, and then suddenly his downward plunge was halted by a pair of strong hands that he knew, beyond question, would always be there for him. "Fly, Robin, fly," his father intoned to him. They swung toward the platform, then back again toward the center as the acclamation of the crowd below swept over them. Mary Grayson was on the opposite platform and with practiced skill sent the other empty trapeze arcing towards them. John Grayson released his son as Dick twirled in midair and snagged the other trapeze. He landed on the platform next to his mother, and together they waved down to the crowd. On the opposite side, Chris waved too as he hauled his father in. "Life doesn't get any better than this, does it, Dad?" Chris said, to which John could only reply, "Never." "Look, I'm rock climbing Sunday," Bruce Wayne said to Chase Meridian. "How about coming along?"
"I'd like to, actually. I love climbing, I really do," he supplied the next obvious word for her.
"But?"
"I guess I've met someone."
"Fast work. You just moved here."
She gave him a sad look. "You know, much to my surprise, you really are terrific, but you could say he kind of dropped out of the sky, and bang, I think he felt it too."
"Oh, my God."
"Bruce?"
She seemed concerned.
"Not again. Not again. This one is fixated on Batman, too. What is it, anyway? The mask? The cape? Bruce?"
And this time her voice was firm, yanking him out of his reverie. "Has anyone ever told you that you can act rather strangely?" "Not to my face," he said. "So, you think he felt it too? Well, of course he did. Who wouldn't?"
In the center ring of the circus, a tiny car roared into the middle. Clowns began tumbling out one over the other. As that happened, the Graysons descended on the guy wires. Chase smiled at the crazed activity. "A land of light and shadow where beasts dance and freaks are kings." He was so startled by the comment that he asked her to repeat it. She did, puzzled, word for word.
"It's a description of the circus, from a fairy tale my mother used to read."
That was all he needed to hear. He took her quickly by the hand and said, "We've got to get out of here, now."
Suddenly the voice of the ringmaster pulled his full attention back to the center ring.
"Ladies and gentlemen, please forget all good American wholesome fun," the ringmaster called out, his face obscured by a hanging Barker's mic. "Tonight, a new act for your amusement. We call it Massacre Under the Big Top."
The newly arrived clowns immediately shed their garments, yanking massive guns out of the oversized clown clothes. Some people in the crowd were still laughing uncertainly,
until a couple of the thugs fired random shots into the air. The unmistakable chatter of the machine guns was the confirmation, for any who still needed it, that the evening had taken a deadly turn. There was panic and screaming, and the ringmaster stepped out from behind the microphone. His hideous split face was now apparent for all to see.
"People, people, show some grace under pressure. A little decorum, please," cautioned Two-Face, and then added, "Shut up or die."
A couple of thugs rolled a round object into the ring. They attached the sphere to ropes hanging from the rafters.
"Inside that harmless-looking orb," continued Two-Face, "are 200 sticks of TNT. In our hand, a radio detonator."
Calmly, he pushed a button on the box. The bomb promptly beeped in response, and continued to do so, one beep per second.
"You have 2 minutes," he informed them, with no more concern in his voice than if he had been hawking red-hots.
An angry voice spoke up from the crowd.
"What the hell do you want?"
Bruce turned to see the origin of the speaker. It was the mayor.
"Want, Mr. Mayor?"
Two-Face called.
"Just one little thing. Batman. Bruised, broken, bleeding. In a word, dead. One of you must know who Batman is. Unless the bat is surrendered to us post-haste, we're off on a proverbial killing spree. You have 2,"
and then he nodded towards the bomb.
"Well, just under 2 minutes."
Wayne rose to his feet, for no secret, not even his, was worth innocent lives. Chase, not understanding what he was about to do, tried to pull him back down. That was when people started to shout and point. He looked up towards the rafters and gaped. The flying Graysons were scaling the scaffolding, heading for the bomb.
"Boys, move, move, move!"
bellowed Two-Face, furious. Several thugs started climbing guy wires. Chris prodded Dick upward.
"Go, we'll hold them off."
In a daring display that made his earlier theatrics tame in comparison, Dick launched himself from trapeze to trapeze, bounced off the high wire, and just managed to snag an overhead catwalk. He hoisted himself up onto the catwalk. One of the thugs grabbed John's leg. John Grayson kicked him away and jumped to another trapeze. Momentarily distracted by her husband's danger, Mary Grayson was unaware of her own. From underneath the platform she was crouched on, one of Two-Face's thugs swung up and slammed into her. Mary Grayson tried desperately to regain her balance, but then gravity seized her and pulled her downward. As one, the audience screamed. At the last instant, Mary snagged a wildly swinging trapeze with her leg. She hung precariously high above the ground. Dick was clambering towards the bomb and was able to see the time clock. It ticked down to 43, and he had the sick feeling that it didn't signify minutes. The thugs, not having signed on for a suicide mission, started sliding down the ropes and guy wires to put distance between themselves and the bomb. John Grayson, meantime, was moving to help his wife, but he couldn't do it alone. "Chris!" he shouted, and as if by magic, Chris was there by his side. Quickly, they clambered out onto a trapeze, John anchoring Chris. "Just like 1,000 times before, Chris," said John calmly. "Same old, same old. Not a problem." John set the trapeze swinging, building momentum. Mary saw them coming. She reached out, stretching her fingers so hard that she felt as if they might fall off her hands. The trapeze twisted and tilted under her one leg, and she felt herself slipping off. Dick, meantime, had his own problems, as he worked quickly to unlash the bomb from the rafters. He heard the chatter of machine gun fire and prayed that it wasn't aimed up at him. Then the bomb came free in his hands, and God help him, he almost dropped the damn thing. It bobbled momentarily, but then he recovered it and inadvertently caught a glimpse of the amount of time he had left. 13 seconds. Meantime, the thugs were inching back towards the trap door through which they'd made their entrance. The moment the bomb went, so would they. But as the crowd panicked, falling one over the other, it was Bruce Wayne's chance. A sea of people came between him and Chase, and he used the opportunity to slide between the rails. Within seconds, he had closed in on one of the guards who blocked the way to Two-Face. Bruce slugged him, and he went down without another sound. Glancing upward, he saw that the daring young man from the flying trapeze had gotten his hands on the bomb and was clambering through a roof hatch. Bruce prayed that the boy, Richard, Chase had said his name was, would be up to it. Then his gaze shifted to the rest of the Graysons high above the ground. The father was swinging the son towards the mother, still twisting between the trapeze and rope. And now they angled back and up towards the trapped woman. The boy's hands closed on his mother's. They had her.
It would be a matter of moments for her to disentangle her leg, free herself, and swing safely with her son and husband to the opposite platform. And then Bruce saw Two-Face. Two-Face and one thug between Bruce and the maniac who had turned a charity evening into a hellish disaster. Bruce charged. This thug was holding a machine pistol, however. Bruce dropped to the ground, bullets cutting the air above his head. He rolled and came up, slamming his feet into the thug's face. Bruce grabbed the gun, but the thug wasn't inclined to let go. The two of them struggled against each other, angling for position, and that's when Bruce saw the coin glittering in the air. Two-Face had to admire them, a gutsy trapeze family. They had decided to try to be heroes. And they were worthy of the same chance that Two-Face afforded other heroes.
"Day in, day out, time passes. Fate has her fancies," he intoned, speaking to an audience only he could hear. "God stands absent, daydreaming, and the universe asks the same old question. Life?" The coin spun in the air and landed at his feet. "Or death?"
He looked down at the scarred head and smiled a twisted smile.
"Our kind of day," he said.
He pulled out his guns and aimed high. Bruce slammed his head into the thug's face. The blow sent him down to the ground, and Bruce grabbed up the machine pistol. He swung the pistol up and aimed it squarely at Two-Face. He had him dead in his sights.
"Dead? You're a killer, too."
And he hurled the machine pistol. It scissored through the air, spinning like a boomerang, and crashed squarely into Two-Face's head, but only after Two-Face had squeezed off two shots. The first bullet sliced through one of the trapeze supports that were suspending John and Chris Grayson. The support snapped, and John Grayson skidded off, clutching onto his son's legs. Chris was still holding onto Mary, and he screamed. His mind hadn't fully registered what happened. He only knew that suddenly he felt as if he were being torn in half. Mary shrieked as well, her frantic hands wrapped around Chris's wrists as he howled, "Don't drop me! Don't drop me, Ma!" And John knew that he was dead, that he was about to let go of his son's leg and plummet to the ground, because then, maybe, just maybe, Mary could hold on and they would survive. The agony for the three flying Graysons seemed to them an eternity, but it was in fact no longer than it took for Two-Face to squeeze the trigger a second time. The second bullet sliced through the rope supporting Mary Grayson. Dick Grayson scrambled across the roof of the Hippodrome, the bomb ticking under his arm. With a prayer, he hurled the bomb down into the water. Seconds later, there was a muffled explosion, and the water erupted upward about 50 feet, sending a geyser and mist through the air before settling back down.
"I did it," he whispered in amazement. "I saved him. This is great! This is great!"
He scampered back up the roof, his mind racing. He was going to be a hero. No, not just him. His whole family were going to be heroes. His joy lasted until he regained the catwalk and looked down and saw the broken bodies of his family lying on the ground. Then he heard a loud, piercing, gut-wrenching scream of agony that seemed to go on. And somewhere along the way, he realized it was his own voice.
"The greatest show on earth!"
crowed Two-Face a split instant before the machine gun hit him. As he went down, he fired wildly in all directions and unknowingly forcing Bruce Wayne to dive for cover. That was when Bruce heard the shriek from on high. He recognized it immediately. It was his own voice. Except it wasn't. It was another voice, but with the same grief and agony that Bruce recalled from himself so many years ago. Bruce and Chase stood outside the Hippodrome, watching the ambulances roll away as more and more police cars seemed to materialize. Bruce felt a certain amount of impatience. What was the purpose of all this? Two-Face was gone. And he was running that moment, the moment, back through his mind. He had sworn not to use guns. A gun was what had cut down his parents, and the very concept of wielding such a weapon was anathema to him. Yet there he had been, holding the machine pistol in his hands, finger curled around the trigger. A quick squeeze, and Two-Face would have been dead. But Bruce's reflexes had kicked in, compelling him to throw the gun instead of firing it. Gently, Chase said to Bruce,
Do you want to talk about it?
He looked at her and shook his head. Then he saw Dick Grayson from a distance. He had a blanket draped over him, covering his red and green leotards. His head was lowered, his face ashen.
He deserved so much better, said Chase. It's so unfair.
What happens to him now? Asked Bruce.
Now? He gets pumped into the system, I guess.
He thought about the system. The overcrowded, underfinanced system.
The hell he does, said Bruce Wayne.